You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brent Simpson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Michael Cannell on the show with me today. He has an amazing new book. It came out just a couple of days ago. It's called A Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder, Inc. And this book is phenomenal. I can't wait for everyone to get their hands on it and read it. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. I'm sincerely really, really excited to be here with you.
I'm excited to have you. Michael, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You know, it's funny that you ask that, because I actually do have a really kind of random and specific memory of that. When I was a kid, I grew up in New York City. My parents had five kids. I think that had something to do with my interest in reading. We were in a kind of crammed into kind of a modest sized New York City apartment. My parents had a falling down old house in Vermont. I mean, it really was an old kind of wonderful but crappy farmhouse. And they would put the five kids and the two dogs in the old 1970s station wagon on the weekends and drive up there. And then, like a military operation, they would somehow get us all out outside doing things, skiing or, you know, chopping wood or something on the weekends. One time I was sick. I think I had a very slight fever, and I just lay in bed for 2 days reading a book about a novel about the Civil War. And I just really disappeared into the world of that book. And I don't know how old I was. Maybe I was probably 9, 10, or 11. I can't really remember. But I do remember thinking, this is what I'd like to do. I would like to write books.
I love that. So you were a bookish kid, obviously. Do you remember, besides that Civil War book, were there other books that just stoked your imagination and that you found yourself just falling, completely into the story?
I don't know that there was any one book or any series of books the way people who, you know, who are of a certain age probably would say something like Harry Potter now. I don't know that anything like that existed when I was a kid, except maybe the Tolkien series. But I read those books that a kid would read in school and that would make an impression on them. I remember reading A Separate Piece. I remember reading 1984. I remember reading sports books. And, I would really devour these things and not really talk to them about anybody about them. And I just was very compartmentalized. It was, maybe that's what happens when you grow up in an apartment with five other kids, is you have to kind of create your own internal world. It's yours.
Michael, were you fascinated by history? Was this a topic that intrigued you?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything. I think history, yes, but I remember reading Ernest Hemingway short stories when I was pretty young. Would we call that, and his novels, would we call The Sun Also Rises history? I mean, in a way it was Paris in the 1920s. So in a way that's history, but I think it was more the storytelling and the way in which effective storytelling is cinematic and projects into your head your own personal movie. I think it was more that than history with a capital H.
Right. Michael, because it rarely works out for most of us, you know, when we have that epiphany, like you did, reading that Civil War book, you know, that you would like to be a writer and this would was a world that you would like to immerse yourself in. It rarely happens that when we turn, you know, 17 or 18, when we finish high school, that we just immediately, you know, go off and become a writer. The life usually intervenes and, you know, there's little things like paying bills and, you know, raising our own families and things like that that get in the way. What was that journey like for you? I know that you had kind of made a commitment in your mind, but what did that look like in the working out of the pursuit of your art?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I graduated from Princeton in 1982, and that was, you know, kind of the beginning of a certain period in the financial life of this country when Wall Street was booming, and it was possible for young people to go to Wall Street and make a lot of money. In fact, Michael Lewis, who wrote his first book, Liar's Poker, was in my class at Princeton. Droves of my classmates and friends went off to Wall Street into training programs and investment banking, et cetera. And I just was not going to do that because I did not have the aptitude for it. I wasn't particularly interested in it, but I also would have been really bad at it. And what I did was to go to a small newspaper in Arlington, Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington, and I wrote obituaries. That was my first job. And when I tell people that, it kind of lands like a punchline, like people think that's funny. But what I want to say to them is, you know, that is a heavy duty thing when you are 21 years old to be writing obituaries on a newspaper. For one thing, it's often the most read section of the newspaper, so it's important. But also, it's important in your development as a writer to do something like that, because I came to understand that everybody has done something really, really interesting in their life. And you know, if you're an obituary writer, you have to find that. You have to find that, and you have to write about it in a way that is factual and in a way that is evocative and also with respect. You know, I mean, it's not okay to make mistakes if you're covering, you know, a budget hearing at City Hall, but it's really, really not okay to make mistakes if you're writing about somebody's life.
That's right.
And the last thing that probably, you know, may be written about. So, I mean, I would tell people this and people sort of treat it like a funny story, and I suppose it is, but I took it really seriously, and I learned a lot about that. So that was my stepping stone from college to other journalism jobs.
Michael, I am reminded of a romantic comedy movie that's usually on the TV at our house around Christmas every year. I think it's called Serendipity. And it's a John Cusack movie, I think. And there's a character in there that is an obituary writer for the New York Times. And he always he kind of wears that as a badge of pride. But he's always kind of not making excuses. That's not the right word. But he's always trying to impart the importance of that role to other people. And you can tell that it's kind of a punchline in the movie. That he's the serious writer who's an obituary writer. But he said something that's always stuck with me. And he said, well, I have the last say about this person's life. And I take it very seriously because I'm going to write the last thing about this person. And it's up to me to bring out the treasure, out of this story. And I've always loved that. I think you're the first person that I've met that has had that role. And I'm glad to know that you took it that seriously and that you feel the importance of that.
Well, it sounds like I cribbed that idea at that movie, but I didn't haven't seen that movie. But now I want to see. Now I have to see that movie.
It's not a great movie, but it's an okay movie.
Yeah. Well, I worked at the New York Times for a bunch of years, and it would, you know, the obituary desk, as it was called, is not where generally where people wanted to end up. But really, as I said earlier, I think that the obituary pages probably are read more than anything else in the newspaper. And I pay very keen attention to them.
So from writing obituaries in Virginia to the New York Times that you mentioned, how did that transition happen and what were you doing at the Times?
What happened is that I went from the Northern Virginia Sun, where I was writing obituary, to a job, sort of a little bit of a detour. I worked at Nickelodeon when Nickelodeon was kind of a new company, and I wrote scripts for a friend of mine who was a producer. I wrote scripts for a TV show that doesn't, you know, a kids' TV show. And then I went to journalism school at Columbia. And from there, I was a stringer, what they call a stringer, sort of a freelance reporter at Time Magazine. And then I was just freelancing at all sorts of places. I was writing magazine articles just like crazy all over the place. And I worked in architecture magazine. And then from there, I went to the New York Times, where because I worked at an architecture magazine, I segued into a job at the New York Times as a design editor in what was then called the House and Home section, which I went in as the deputy editor of that section and was later, 6 months later, I was the editor of that section. So I was a section, what they call a section editor at the time. So I was responsible for producing my own section of the newspaper that came out weekly, came out every Wednesday. And that section does not exist anymore, unfortunately. But I was there about 8 years.
Wow. So from writing obituaries to working at the Times as a section editor, I'm looking at your Amazon page, the first book it looks like that you published is The Limit, Life and Death on the 1961 Grand Prix Circuit, which looks like an amazing book. But how do you go from where you were at the Times to writing a book that seems to be so very specific about something that we all know a little bit about, but I don't know very many people that are very deep on the 1961 Grand Prix circuit. How did this come to grab
really,
your attention?
It's really unlikely, but I should point out that I actually had written a book before I went to the Times about architecture. It was a biography of the architect I.M. Pei. So that book about car racing was actually my second book. But you know, how did I come to that? Well, I had in that period when I was a freelance magazine writer, I wrote a lot of sports articles. I wrote for Sports Illustrated quite regularly. And so I at that time I kind of had one foot in the world of architecture and design and another foot in the world of sports. Really kind of unlikely, and I would not have planned it that way, but I just think like life and careers work that way. And so, you know, I was at the Times and I had a really good job there. I think it would have been hard to do that job longer than 8 years. Really, it was a fantastic job, but a tough job. I was ready to move either to another job in that building or to do something else. There was a New York Times correspondent in Europe who covered Grand Prix racing, Formula One, in the 50s and the 60s, named Robert Daly. And somehow his book about covering those races ended up on my desk in the New York Times newsroom. And I looked at it and I saw his photographs And I thought, my God, you know, what a world that was. Monte Carlo in 1961. There isn't really anything more sexy and glamorous than Monte Carlo. You know, these races in Monte Carlo in 1961. But it was also a deadly world, because in those days, the drivers died all the time. And I thought, Jesus, if I could find a story in that world, it would just be so great to write a book about Europe in the late 50s and early 60s. And so I started reading about that world, and almost immediately the story about a rivalry between two drivers jumped out at me, one of whom was the first American to break into that world, and the other one was his teammate on the Ferrari race team, a handsome German nobleman. These two men were opposites in every imaginable way. And in 1961, it was very clear that one of them was going to win the championship, and most likely the other one would die. And that's exactly what happened. And so that book is not really a book about, it's not really a sports book. It's not a car book. It's really a book about these two men.
Papyrus Author was designed and developed with the modern writer's needs, wishes, and preferences in mind. From big structures right down to tiny details, every single feature of our software has been carefully and meticulously crafted in collaboration with authors. Take charge of your writing with the Author interface, which gives you access to different elements of your story, such as characters, backgrounds, and narrative structure. Move sections of your writing seamlessly in the Navigator and evaluate the complexity of your text with our expert style and readability analysis. Never worry about losing progress with automated backups. With Papyrus Author, you can be your own writer, editor, and publisher. The world of writing is about to change. Papyrus Author, the word processor for authors, has arrived on the international stage, unrivaled in its scope. It is the first software suite to unite every single step of creative writing. The vision behind Papyrus Author is to empower everyone with an idea to turn it into a great book for free. A word processing core that matured for over 10 years at its foundation, Papyrus Author goes beyond the text with its intuitive organizing layers for story, characters, notes, and research. The powerful style and readability analysis help raise manuscript quality. The inbuilt publication capabilities take the book directly to the reader with ebooks, DocX, and print-ready PDF. Visit papyrusauthor.com to get started today. Do you want to get paid to write stories? Do you enjoy collaborating with other talented storytellers? Do you want to work completely remotely and set your own hours? Relay Publishing is looking for writers and editors to work on fiction projects across a range of genres, from thrillers to sci-fi, fantasy, and romance. The Relay process is extremely collaborative, in the same vein as a TV show's writer's room. If you're a story geek, then you'll be on a great team. There are 7 ghostwriting positions and 10 editing positions currently available. Please go to www.recruitment.relaypub.com. That's www.recruitment.relaypub.com for more information on how to apply. Join a great storytelling team today. I heard someone say one time that sports movies and sports books are not really about sports. They're about the human condition, and they're about how we interrelate with one another and the competition that springs up, and then what that brings out of our nature through the contest of sports. And do you find that to be true? I mean, the book obviously is based around the 1961 Grand Prix, but the story is not about the cars racing. The story is about something that we connect with on a deeper level. How do you find that thing that people connect with?
You said it a lot better than I could. One of the reviewers who reviewed that book said, this is not a story about sports. This is a story about life. And that was really the way I hoped it would come across. The American driver, whose name was Phil Hill, was the son of an abusive alcoholic. And so for him, cars were a way to escape into a world which was predictable. Motors are predictable. The cars are predictable. He was sort of spent his whole life trying to immerse himself, to escape, I guess I should say, into a world in which, unlike his abusive father, he was trying to escape into a world in which he was in control, and he knew that for every action, there would be a predictable reaction. His friend and rival, Wolfgang von Trips, the German nobleman, grew up in a Germany which had been decimated by World War II. And he grew up wanting to be the handsome face of a new Germany. He wanted to redeem Germany in some way. He wanted Germany to rise from the ashes and achieve greatness again, but a more palatable, acceptable German greatness. And so that's really what I tried to focus on in that book, and not, yes, the races are all in that book, but it was those struggles of those two men that I really tried to focus on.
A few years later, you published a book, Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, The Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling. This book I find fascinating, Michael, because there's a show that came out on Netflix a couple of years ago, I think, Mindhunter, I believe it's called, where we get to look into the minds of the FBI agents who created what we now refer to as criminal profiling. And this book really digs into that. While seemingly on the surface may be very different from your first book, at the core, we're kind of dealing with some of the same issues, even though it's the window dressing of the story is very different. How do you feel about the differences and the similarities of these books, and why did you choose this topic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, or a couple of questions. They're really kind of set in something like the same time period, and I didn't really set out to do that. The way it happened is that when I was working on the car racing book, I spent a lot of time reading newspapers on microfilm in the New York Public Library. On the one hand, fantastic to read these old newspapers. On the other hand, my friends from college that I mentioned earlier were all across the street making God knows how much money, and I was over there in the reading microfilm as if I were still in junior high school. And I was reading an Argentinian newspaper, English-speaking Argentinian newspaper, about a car race for the car racing book. And while I was reading that newspaper, I just noticed a headline in that paper adjacent to the car racing story was an article about the Mad Bomber of New York. And it just caught my eye. And so I read that article, and it was about the police's desperate search for a serial bomber in New York in the mid-50s. And, it sounds strange to say it. I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I kind of knew that was going to be my next book right at that moment. I just felt like that is that is a book worthy story. And the, you know, what that led me to was an understanding that this was the first time that the police had gone to a psychiatrist to solve a crime of this kind. And so it was really the origins of what we now call criminal profiling. You mentioned Mindhunter. When Mindhunter came out, I watched it with great interest because really what I wrote was a prequel to Mindhunter. Mindhunter never acknowledged it, but the truth is that the FBI didn't know how to do criminal profiling, and they didn't really develop it on their own. They went to the psychiatrist who helped the police in this bombing case, who had developed this on his own, and he shared his technique with the FBI. And of course, the FBI took his technique and adapted it and turned it into something, you know, much grander because they had the resources to do that and the data to do that. But it really started with this one psychiatrist who honestly was about as crazy as the bomber was, but he was brilliant. And when the police showed him all the evidence, he said, he studied the evidence for several hours and he said, and this sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm not. He said, the man you're looking for has never had a girlfriend. He has a history of workplace disputes. His family comes from Eastern Europe. When you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted jacket. And that all turned out to be true.
That is fascinating.
And you can imagine how that struck detectives in Chicago, Sacramento, St. Louis, Los Angeles, who were struggling on cold cases. They thought, here's a guy who has figured out how to profile. And so of course his phone began to ring, and he went on to work on many high profile cases, including the Boston Strangler case in Boston.
Books like this and the way you tell the story of what's going on is it reads like a novel. You know, narrative nonfiction is one of my favorite things to read because it reads like something that the best novelist would make up, yet it's absolutely true. How do you find the narrative thread of what the story is? Because I mean, this is obviously not a biography of any particular person in here, but it's a window into a time and a place and the things going on. How do you decide what that window is that you're going to give us a view into?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess as all of these questions are. I am trying to write narrative nonfiction. I mean, I really do want these nonfiction books to seem like they're novels, or better yet, I want them to seem like they're Netflix shows. I really do. And that means that I can't tell everything, right? I mean, in the old days, people wrote nonfiction books, they would be big books and they would kind of tell everything. This is, you know, sort of a newer form of storytelling. So I have to figure out, as you say, what the window is, what the frame of the window is. Because if you tell everything, then, you know, then you're not telling a story so much as you are just delivering a huge load of information. And that's not really storytelling, right? So, you know, how do I do that? I mean, I try to storyboard it, right? So who people who make TV shows or movies, one step in their process is to take the script and turn it into storyboards. How is the story, like, how does the script become visual? The storyboards, you know, show in a kind of crude form what each film shot is going to be. And I do try to think about the story in that kind of cinematic terms. You know, what is the next scene? I don't know what other people would say about this, but to me, the more I can tell the story with these visuals in mind, the better. It just, you know, what I have said to people is, if you want a really, really clear picture, you need a lot of it's about the pixels. So I just try to think of it in those visual terms, going scene by scene and leaving out, you know, it's only after I've been doing this for a while that I have had the confidence to leave a lot of information out.
Well, I think that's what separates it for your work from something like a David McCullough or Walter Isaacson biography. We know that when we read one of those books, we're going to get a very detailed linear timeline that's going to be very entertaining, and he's going to bring out you know, details that maybe we didn't know, and aspects of it, his character's interpersonal relationships. But it's going to be a very narrow focus on whatever that biography is about. And when with a Michael Cannell book, we know that we're going to get a big picture view of an incident or a particular window into time with all of the nuance. And I think that's the difference, is that we know that we're going to get, like you said, you want to write like a Netflix show, and it definitely reads like that. Do you have any favorite books or authors in the genre that you write in that that you go to the well for inspiration?
Well, like everybody else who's trying to do this kind of thing, I worship at the altar of Eric Larson. I think he's kind of a magician, and I've never met him, but I just. How does he do what he does? He does this narrative nonfiction. He makes it seem effortless. I know his last book was about Churchill during the London Blitz, and
The Splendid and the Vile, I believe it was.
The Splendid and the Vile, and he must have done just like a massive amount of research. But it doesn't. You would never know that. It doesn't. You know, people, I think writers often feel like they need to broadcast to the reader that they've done their homework by showing them the homework. It's taken me a while to figure out that that's a mistake. With Eric Larson, you never feel that way. It's just the story. You don't feel like you're reading an encyclopedia entry. He just somehow knows. He knows how to take you into that world, and it's just a pleasure. It's like taking a warm bath. It's like time travel. So of course Eric Larson, and the great Laura Hillenbrand, who wrote Seabiscuit and Unbroken. I guess I would say the same thing. The same things about her. She's maybe a little more writerly. Her writing is a little more, I don't know what the word would be, literary. If you read the beginning of Seabiscuit, it's like a virtuoso is writing it. I mean, for people who are interested in narrative nonfiction, they should just start with those two authors.
So, Michael, that brings us to your new book, which just released a couple of days ago, Brotherhood Betrayed, The Man Behind the Rise and Fall of Murder, Inc. For those of us that are outside New York City and who obviously were born past 1941, we've heard of Murder, Inc. We know some about it. But what was it about this story that piqued your interest?
I think the whole thing about authors and story subjects is kind of mysterious. I mean, you can't go out really and just shop for a story idea the way you would shop for something at CVS. You kind of have to wait, I think, and keep your eyes peeled and be patient and watchful. And this story just kind of caught my eye. And as with my other book projects, I just started to read about it and I just could tell. I could tell immediately, like this just, it just immediately seemed like a Netflix series. So I'll just try to tell you very succinctly what it's about. It's so during Prohibition, the mafia gangsters, by the way, the mafia never used the term mafia, so I really shouldn't call them that, but I will. They made money without trying. Prohibition was just so easy for them because of the gambling and speakeasies, and they controlled the speakeasies and the bootlegging. They controlled everything. And they made mountains of money without trying. But then when Prohibition ended, they figured they had to do business a different way. And that was the moment when organized crime really became organized. And part of that organization meant that they had to have an organized and efficient way of protecting themselves by killing informants or anybody who could potentially be an informant, anybody who might testify against them in court. And this was the time when the mob bosses, in particular Lucky Luciano, they formed a national alliance of mobs. And they really wanted to run it in this super efficient, they wanted to run it like General Motors. They wanted to run it like a company. And so their idea was, we're going to have an assassination squad that will kill all the informants. And so they turned to a Jewish gang in Brooklyn. And interesting, because the sort of like stereotype of this is that the Italian guys are the tough guys, and the Jewish guys who worked around the mob were more, sort of more involved in the money side. But for this one moment, it was the opposite. And so this Jewish gang, which was headed by a guy named Abe Reles, they became an assassination squad known as Murder Incorporated. And they traveled all over the country killing members of the mob who were informants, or maybe going to be informants, or had otherwise caused problems. And I don't think this is true, but by some counts, they killed as many as 1,000 people. I don't, you know, they didn't exactly keep careful records on this, so nobody really knows. I think it was more like hundreds and not 1,000. But in any case, Abe Reles, after organizing this purge of informants, he then became an informant himself. And he became the most important and talkative informant in mob history. He'd have been involved in all of these hundreds of murders, and he told the district attorneys and the police about all of them. And he had an incredible cinematic memory. So, you know that expression, to know where the bodies are buried? He literally knew where the bodies were buried, hundreds of them. And this was the way that the district attorneys were going to bring down the mob. They knew that the mob was going to try to kill Abe Reles before he could testify in the most important trials. They kept him under layers of guard in a Coney Island hotel. And then the night before one of the big trials, he went out the window of his hotel room and died. The police called it an escape attempt, but nobody thinks it was an escape. Somebody threw him out the window. He did not go out that window voluntarily. The question was, who was it? Was it the mob? Did the mob pay off the police to do it? there is reason to believe that the police may have been involved because, of course, Abrelles knew about all the police who were paid off. And in fact, the district attorney of Brooklyn, who was soon to become mayor, a man named William O'Dwyer, he may have known about this or have been involved in some way. And when there were starting to be questions asked, he was appointed, President Harry Truman appointed him ambassador to Mexico. And so he was shuffled out of New York City. And this is one of the great mysteries in the history of organized crime. Who was it that killed Abrelles, and for what exactly?
So, like you mentioned earlier with Eric Larson, that you know that he just consumes massive amounts of information, but instead of just regurgitating that information onto the page, he finds the story in there and then lets that just come out naturally from what he's absorbed. When you're dealing with a topic like Abrelles and Murder Incorporated, I would think that it's probably much easier to find all sorts of information about Churchill than it is a character like Abrelles. How do you find the material that you're going to absorb and start looking for the story in when you've got a character that's maybe a little unsavory, and that there are lots of people, I'm sure, that would love for the story to just go away, and instead of there just being volumes and volumes and volumes available about this character? How do you prepare for a story like this?
Yeah, I really believe in interviewing people. I mean, since I've spent my entire adult life working at newspapers and writing magazine articles, I really believe in the power of interviewing people. There's nothing like hearing somebody talk about something that brings stories to life. But it wasn't really possible in this case. I could do it with that car racing book because some of the people who didn't die in that car racing book were still alive. But it wasn't possible. This story takes place, for the most part, in the 1930s. So nobody around to interview. So fortunately for me, a lot of interviews were conducted by newspaper reporters on my behalf, I guess. And, you know, these murders and the trials that followed were heavily covered by big city newspapers, but also by small newspapers. That was a period when Brooklyn itself had, I don't know, Brooklyn probably had six newspapers. So there was a lot there that I could draw from. And also the court transcripts. So to hear people's, if I could not hear people's voices myself, I could hear them through the transcripts and also through the depositions conducted with some of these characters. And it's an awesome experience to, excuse me, to read these depositions or court transcripts. And it is like time travel. It's as if you're there. It's as if you're sitting there in the courtroom in 1940. So I use that material, lots and lots and lots and lots of newspaper articles, and also FBI files, which I got through the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI files were not as helpful as I thought they were going to be. Mostly they were memos that officials of the FBI were writing each other about stuff that everybody knew. They seemed to be writing these memos to each other as if to impress each other, but there wasn't that much new information in them. But yeah, like I said before, I think it's about trying to collect as many pixels as possible. And fortunately for me, the newspaper articles just had, you know, just had a lot of really gritty, colorful information in them.
A story like this about an organization like Murder Incorporated, the narrative is taking place 80, 90 years ago. The world was a very different place then, and the way that business and air quotes business were handled then could be very different from today with today's technology. But there's something very poignant about this story, and this kind of story could happen today, even though the world is very different. Were there parallels that you were able to draw as you were writing this and studying this about this place and time and the way that this could happen today?
Well, I don't know if this is what you have in mind, but I'll tell you what comes to my mind as I hear you ask that question is what comes to mind is the world of our politics today. Many of the ways of conducting themselves from that period, the way that the mafia conducted themselves, the intimidation, the ways of speaking in a kind of code language, the way in which they often got their way by just hinting really obliquely about intimidation to come, the ways in which no matter what happened, the boss profited. While I was working on this book, of course, Trump was president, and the headlines were filled with stories about Michael Cohen and everything else that, you know, that followed. I don't know that I want to take this conversation to a political place, but if I'm going to be honest, that was what was in my mind. I wasn't particularly looking for it, but there was just like a very clear echo between the politics of Washington at this time and the politics of organized crime in the 1930s, which is to say, I guess, that the things in this book are probably eternal. Stories about loyalty and betrayal probably have always played out, and they always will play out.
Well, stories of loyalty and betrayal go back as far as Cain and Abel. I mean, these are human stories, if there ever have been. The new book, A Brotherhood Betrayed, out, available everywhere now. The man behind the rise and fall of Murder Incorporated. Michael, I love this book. I love everything that you're doing. We're going to put links to this book in the show notes of this episode to make it easy for people to find. But is there a place people can find you if they want to dig into all the fascinating work that you're doing?
Oh, yeah, I appreciate your asking. I have an author website. It's myfullname.com. So that's michaelcannell.com. Cannell is spelled C-A-N-N-E-L-L. michaelcannell.com. So these books that we've just talked about, they're all there.
Great. And we'll be sure to link it up in the show notes to make it easy for people to find. Michael, we could talk all day. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. And we wish you much success on the launch of A Brotherhood Betrayed.
Hey, this has been great. I really appreciate it.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates. PubSite is the new, easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.
Do you ever wonder if a person's critical thinking comes at the expense of their own happiness? Is it possible to be very happy and still practice excellent discernment? I used to wonder the same thing. Then I discovered the Trouble in Paradise podcast with Nigel Kent and Jasmine Starr, where they laugh as well as think about conspiracy theories and unexplained phenomena without ever getting bogged down in the age-old tug-of-war between logic and feeling. The Trouble in Paradise podcast is a joyful program for critical thinkers who have a sense of humor. Join Nigel and Jasmine as they probe the intriguing and wacky culture of odd occurrences, strange news, and ridiculous coincidences on this hilariously intelligent podcast. Trouble in Paradise on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Stitcher. Follow at Tipcast239 on Twitter. Trouble in Paradise with Nigel Kinn and Jasmine Starr, a happy podcast for critical thinkers like you.